Hello again, Asymptote listeners. This is Layla Benitez-James, and in this episode, we're getting a little crafty and speaking with some translators and writers about the specific strategies which go into their practice. Though first, I'd like to say that we have a new issue fresh off the press with work from 30 countries. In our spring 2017 edition of Asymptote, my favorite to date, we have a special feature on literatures from banned countries, headlined by Mahmoud Dawlatabadi and Osama Alomar. There is fantastic new poetry and a delightful and very strange essay on the Whig by Luigi Amara, as well as philosophical fiction by Herman Berger, set entirely in a train's dining car. There are also lots of ways to get involved, and if you enjoy what we do, please support our work. You can easily join Asymptote as a sustaining member today, and just now, we have a bonus gift in the form of an ebook anthology of our travel band feature, which houses some amazing additional work that is not available online. Lately, I've been thinking a lot about the process of translation and devouring essays on craft. While translators have styles just as diverse as individual writers, this common thread of isolation kept cropping up. The image of the lone translator wrestling with the text until they uncover some trick, some key that propels them towards clicking the pieces of the puzzle into place. Right in our spring issue, for instance, is a brilliant essay by Susanna Basso, who translates into Italian such diverse voices as Ian McEwan, Chimamanda Adichie, and Angela Carter. In her Lessons in Slowness, translated into English for us by Matilda Colarossi from the longer collection On Translation, Militant Experiences and Digressions, she sets such a scene for us. She says, "Translating is beautiful in autumn, when the days are short and I need to turn my desk lamp on earlier. Natural light distracts me a little. It lights up the room, all of the other books, the furniture, the curtains. Here, in this circle of white light that isolates me, we are truly alone, the sentences and I. For every book I have translated, I could tell you what was happening inside this room and in the outside world. This would, I imagine, be anything but interesting, and yet my life has accompanied the life of these words I have looked up, and it has, for me, not been easy to keep them in check. As a young woman, I translated while in a little white room with no wardrobe, on a bare table, and near a phone that kept interrupting me, and kept dragging me outside to the thousands of things that I had asked others to expect of me. I had yet to come to terms with the slowness translation imposes. I remember trying to invent ways to go faster. I was convinced that experience would make me faster. I would often get frustrated. I would find almost every text repetitive, almost every author a little bit wordy." Even though it is spring now and our desk lamps are being turned on later and later, not needed here in Madrid until close to 9 at night, swap out the interrupting phone for a laptop and various other screens, and my experience has been much the same. This process is slow, slow going, and can end up being lonely work. Luckily, we translators have a habit of sharing with each other our experiences as well, as we gather them, and there are ever-increasing ways to share with one another. Back in January, I was preparing to return from a visit to my hometown of Austin, back to Madrid, when I got the opportunity to indulge in one of my other passions, baking. By stodging, or informally working for a day in a kitchen where a good friend worked as a chef. Through steam and salmony smoke and dishes getting blasted clean with hot, high-pressure hoses, the chefs and workers called back and forth to one another, helping each other find tools and ingredients, calling behind to avoid collisions, and calling each other over to taste a batch of potatoes pureed nearly into silk or newly spun, braided, and baked pretzels. I marveled at how different this world was from my own, where much of my interaction with other translators takes place over email. But as I began to work out some pastry recipes and tried not to get in the way, I did find some hidden layers overlapping. As I set up my station under the guidance of their pastry chef, she explained a term they borrow from the French, mise en place. Everything in its place and a place for everything. By beginning with a well-organized space and with all the pieces of their puzzle at hand, they are able to assemble and prepare with dizzying speed and efficiency all the plates which need to go out for the day. She even told me how the phrase had evolved to function as more of an English verb, as they would talk about needing to mise it out and mising out their station. I realized that, of course, this is what I had begun to do at home. Only instead of flour, sugar, and pans of blooming gelatin for making chocolate glaze, I had my source text, a dictionary in book form, and a fan of tabs open on my computer, ranging from word reference to various Google image searches and a couple of Word documents. After that realization, I've become more and more curious as to how technology gets folded into other translators' stations, or how they think about their own setups at home or in offices. Last spring in Paris, I'd picked up a copy of Tram 83 by Fiston Mujila of the Democratic Republic of Congo in the original French, which I could not yet read, but I'm hoping to learn. Later, I visited Deep Vellum Books, a ways north of my hometown up in Dallas, and picked up a copy of the novel translated by Roman Glaser, who had written a fantastic craft essay for Asymptote back in 2015 about translating the work and going on a bit of an adventure with the author. And it's well worth going back to check it out. Glaser studied theater, cinema, and art history in the UK and France and has worked extensively in the performing arts. He was a French Voices and Pen Translates Award winner, and after living in Paris for many years, is currently based in London, where he was kind enough to correspond with me via email and over a phone conversation to explain a bit about how he operates.
So how do you use technology in your translation practice?
Well, I don't use CAT tools, I mean computer-aided translation tools, some are referred to as TENS, translation environment tools. But anyway, I mean I do own a copy of Trados, which I used to use sometimes for translation and stuff like that. The translation memory software sort of remembers stuff you've done already and then that reminds you of the chunk that you're working on is similar or not. But I don't really use that anymore. That's kind of good stuff that's very repetitive, like contracts or online clothing catalogues or stuff like that, but got formal literature. I do have colleagues, I use it for literature simply because it's a convenient way of displaying source text and target text side by side. Otherwise, I guess the only technology would be the internet, I guess. I use it obviously for a lot of research. I use wordreference.com as an easy go-to dictionary, which I'm usually using more to check how exactly to say something in English or to jog my memory rather than to find out what something means, because I'm fortunate to speak French well enough that relatively few words that I actually just don't know what they are. So usually it's as a kind of aide de mémoire to see what sort of possible translations there are. Are there nuances between sort of words that maybe mean similar things? So I use word reference quite a lot. Occasionally more specialist dictionaries online, less so for literature, although that can crop up. I mean, there's the IATE, which is basically the EU's, the European Union's terminology database, which isn't always entirely reliable, but sort of is quite a good hint if you're looking for, I don't know, for a particular couple of things. Otherwise, Wikipedia is a lot, largely because you can handily check, find the topic you want or the subject you want in English, then, or in French rather, and then see what it is in English, and that might quite often lead you to finding out how things are referred to in English or in French. I mean, they're not always, obviously, Wikipedia articles are not always direct translations, but it's kind of a handy way to check things. Often that's particularly useful for things like animals, birds, plants. You can sort of check using the Latin botanical name if it's the right one or not, with the place names.
And so what does it look like multiple tabs that you have open, like a word reference and Wikipedia and then maybe some other reference and then the physical book?
On my browser, I always have word reference open because I'm usually going to need that. I mean, I might over rely on it, to be honest. It kind of, use too, which I guess is all the technology. We can maybe loop back to that in a moment. But yeah, for example, my browser, I have Word reference open and usually a Google window and sometimes a Wikipedia window. Yeah, and that's about it really. And then I'm working Word. Increasingly, I'm sort of switching off my email client on my computer because that kind of gets too distracting.
Yeah, and so for example, like in Trim 83, were you searching for images as well? Like, his writing is very visual.
Not really for Trim 83. I do image searches surprisingly little, I think, compared to, maybe just the kind of things I'm allowed to write on, to work on compared to what I think for some people, other colleagues, sort of have used that a lot. In Trim 83, not particularly. I mean, I did ask the author a lot of questions, but then mainly to do with what precisely he meant, what precisely he meant about a particular turn of phrase. And in the case of the author, Sistomo de Mushkila, he quite likes to do his own surreal twists on existing idioms. And so I have to check, is that a real idiom that I don't know? Is it something that you kind of boosted? Is it something that sort of pertains specifically to Central Africa and Congo? There weren't really, in that case, much in way of images. Yeah, I think these images are surprisingly little.
Yeah.
With regards to paper dictionaries, I had two quite accessible ones. The specifically French one, which is the Harrop's unabridged two-volume French-English dictionary. One volume is English to French, which gets very little use, and the other one is French to English, which gets a lot more use. And I find that particular dictionary has definitions in, for example, that you won't find in the Collins Robert, which, I used to use quite a lot. And wordreference.com is, I believe that they get their corpus from, I think it's LaRousse and Collins, often on the interface, on the user interface on Word Reference, you get sort of a couple of tabs inside it, and one will say Word Reference, but I think they get from LaRousse, and the other one will be Collins, and that gives slightly different definitions. But there's sort of things that won't be in there, they'll usually be in the Harrop's. So that's the more recent acquisition, I say more recently, about 3 or 4 years ago. But it has proved really quite essential. The other one, which is really, 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 really important, is Roger's thesaurus, the original thesaurus, which is quite different from a dictionary. I mean, there are actually synonym dictionaries which are produced and they're called thesauruses, but they're not. The main difference being that the thesaurus, or Jay's thesaurus, works by grouping words according to theme. So, for example, whereas I think synonym dictionary sort of is more about other words for the same thing. So, for example, I just opened it at random, entry 226, covering, and you get a long list of nouns, tapping, superposition, overlaying, overlapping, imbrication, and then it sort of has sort of on the soil, topping, icing, frosting, and then you'll have a section sort of adjectives to do with things that cover other things. And that's really, really useful if, what was it I was looking for the other day? It was a word in French, coin, T-R-O-U-I-L-L-E, which means fear, fright. Stage fright, for example, is toy, and I wanted another word than front, particularly because the word pearl, which also means fright, was used a couple of lines later, and I didn't want to use sort of the same word. form first as you scan through, and that will then remind you maybe of what the noun is or something else. And so I find that really, really useful. Because the synonym dictionary, I guess you look up fright, and you get sort of, I suppose you have other words for it, but it's sort of the somatic one sort of casts its net much wider if you see what I mean. So that I find really, really useful. And then, yeah, I have a French monolingual dictionary, the Petit Robert, which again is useful for some terms, some idioms, which may be in my English tree or not very well, because then that will explain much more specifically how they're used. And that is pretty much it. I have an art history dictionary, which is an Elsevier art history dictionary, which was shockingly expensive even 10 years ago. But lots of terms to do with art history, and also archaeology, and, you know, names of bits of architectural features and stuff like that. And I have a couple of style guides, but I usually use internet for that, because I'm always forgetting. There's certain sort of holes, things that I always have to look up. Like, for example, I always forget how to start work, how to accommodate or recommend, and how many C's and how many N's, and I just have to look at them up repeatedly.
Oh, yeah.
I'm always forgetting whether, you know, the difference between air to and air with. I have to keep that up, you know. Grammar Girl and things like that are quite useful.
Yeah, I like Grammar Girl a lot, actually. Yeah.
There was one other dictionary, actually, which is quite good. It's called the Sussurra Slang, and this was recommended to me by the doctor in English translator, David Coleman. It's published by Faxon File, an InfoBase Holdings company. God knows what that is. It's by Esther Lewin and Albert E. Lewin. And it's more, I think, focused on US English. But, you know, for example, if I look up the woman, here's what helps us, and it suggests other adjectives such as handcuffed, with one's hands tied, pinned, basket cape, over a barrel, tapped, tapped out, up the creek, but down the paddle, etc., etc. So it's quite good for slang, both, I guess, vulgar slang and less vulgar slang. You know, if you want to look up the sort of, if you don't want to say police, but you don't want to say cop, you know, what other word can you use, or things like that. That's quite useful as well.
Yeah, that's great. And then away from the kind of more technical aspects, one thing I really liked about the article that you wrote for Asymptote a couple years ago was this kind of idea of getting lost with the author, or, you know, we don't always have the opportunity to actually talk with people that we're translating,
yeah.
But how was that important to actually be able to meet with him and have that sort of interaction for that book?
It felt like it was important. I mean,
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, you know, as translators, we love the opportunity to procrastinate, to, you know, going and traveling somewhere for the service. As it were, is always good. Partly I've been meeting him, it partly comes from my other career, which was in theatre, performing arts, where I've mostly been the lighting designer, but I've done a bit of acting and producing bits and pieces of that, and that's very much collaborative craft. And, you know, at the beginning when you're putting on a play, for example, you know, you director and actors go off and meet with the playwright and discuss things, and there's research you do, and you approach the text very much in, you kind of break it down into bits, the same way as I guess you prepare to shoot a film, for example. So I guess I have a bit of that approach to a translation. So I guess an element of wanting to know where this text comes from. I don't know that it's always useful. I think in the case of something like Cloud 83, partly because it was written by an author from a part of the world that I've never been to, not hugely familiar with, I felt that was kind of important. I felt that I knew I had questions for him, so I thought it would be good to establish a rapport, because I wanted to, I knew I'd want to ask him a lot of questions. I think it was important for me to establish a rapport with him to see whether, you know, he would be interested in having that kind of, I guess, collaborative involvement, you might say, on the translation, or that kind of input or not. And also because it would make that easier. And also, I had some questions about to do with some of his intent in the novel, because in the case of Tram 83, which takes place in a rebel-held city in an unnamed, war-torn African country, which is based on the Congo and specifically on the city of Lubumbashi, where this storm comes from. I was interested to what extent he thought this was a novel about the Congo and to what extent his aims were perhaps more universal. universal. It turned out it was more the latter. He felt it had a universal reach. So there was that. I mean, sort of just to have that in mind whilst working on the text. And in fact, I think when I first met him, I did have some sort of a few questions already to do with things that had come up in the book. So I think that was it, really. Sort of by and large, I think particularly for literary works, for books which are more than just telling a story, more than just narrative, but there's something else going on, it's quite useful to do that. And I think it's also pleasant. I mean, Fifth Door, I would consider him a friend, consider each other friends, so that's obviously quite pleasant too, particularly sort of in the business we're in, which can often be quite solitary, and you're working on your own, and you know, unless you're working on a code translation, you don't really have a colleague. So yeah.
All right, well, that's great. That's it. Yeah, thank you so much.
I am reminded again of Basso's lessons in slowness as she confides that dictionaries were, for me, the rafts to which I could, for a moment, fasten a mental silence, in the hopes of replacing it as quickly as possible with a word. I would barricade myself, sometimes physically, behind their solid paper towers to protect myself from an insidious army of doubts. When hearing from other translators, I am driven, perhaps as some sort of productive procrastination, to seek out more anecdotes, to hear their experiences so that I may further streamline my own. As luck would have it, my curiosity was indulged further and was able to extend from fiction into poetry as Susanna B. Evans offered us a conversation on craft that she arranged at the Stanza Poetry Festival in St. Andrews in Scotland, where she was working as a sound technician, translator, and interpreter. Evans was born in London and studied at the Universities of York and St. Andrews, where she traveled in the first week of March and sat down with poets Aurelia Lessac and Teresa Baring to discuss the specifics of a translation workshop taking place for the festival. Maintenant quand je danse sous le ciel, c'est comme ça que je finis. Dans ce truc qui peut parfois se montrer si belle, même si c'est bien l'enfer que j'y vis. Même si c'est bien l'enfer que j'y vis. Même si c'est bien l'enfer que j'y vis.
I'm here as part of Stanza Poetry Festival, which is the international festival of poetry in Scotland. And I'm speaking with Aurelia Lessac and Tessa Baring, two poets who are taking part in the translation workshop that is running as part of Stanza. Aurelia Lessac is a poet who lives in the south of France. She writes in French and Occitan. And her last collection was translated into English, Norwegian, Dutch, and Hebrew. And her collection, which is in English and Occitan, is called Solstice and Other Poems. It was published in 2012. And I am also with Tessa Baring, who is an Edinburgh-based writer and artist and a sculptor. She studies sculpture at Edinburgh College of Art. And she has a chapbook forthcoming with the Dancing Girl Press called Cut Glass and No Flowers. And I was wondering if I could start, Aurelia, by asking you to tell me a little bit about the translation workshop that's happening in Stanza, who it involves, and what's happening.
Yeah. So this workshop is organised by the Scottish Poetry Library and Literary Europe Life, Literary Across Frontiers. And, well, the poets are two from... what shall we say, United Kingdoms? Mm-hmm. Tessa Baring and Vicky Fever. And myself and Michel Cassir. And we are accompanied in these marvelous days by Ryan van Winkle.
Excellent. And so you've been working with Tessa Baring, who is the Edinburgh-based poet, and you've both been translating each other's work from... So Tessa's been translating your work from French, and you've been looking at Tessa's work in English. Tessa, I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about how that experience has been for you, whether it's been very challenging, whether it's been quite exciting, or what your feeling has been about the whole experience.
Yes, it's been exciting and challenging. I think the most interesting thing has been just looking at what happens when you bring two languages together and put them side by side, because I think what you realise is that at so many levels, two different languages can be very intimate with each other, but at another level, there's places where the languages just completely diverge, and so you have to find a way of creating a new bridge between them and to recreate that sense of, well, just to recreate the poetry, really. I think there is a quote which I brought with me, which was, "Poetry is what is lost in translation." And I've been very aware of that when I've done the more literal translations, that yes, it makes sense, but the poetry has gone. So it's finding a way to, yeah, join languages intimately and recreate the poetry and, yeah, see what happens.
How many poems of each other's have you translated? What was your way of going about this? Which poems did you decide to...
We didn't count, indeed. We just worked a full day by pairs.
Yeah.
So I did a full day with Tessa, and then I did a full day with Vicky, and etc. And so it's more a time of work than a number of poems. So from Tessa, I translated 16 short poems, and it went very well. And we were very quiet working together, but each one on her side, and then talking when we had a question to ask to each other. And yeah, so I translated her from English to Occitan, because I guess the audience would be curious, and and Tessa too, to get translated in a more rare and minority language. But it's interesting, because I discovered something I didn't know about a flower, this flower, the marigold. She uses it in two poems, and in French we call it souci. So souci, how would you translate souci?
Worry. Yeah.
So I discovered that the Occitan word for marigold is happiness. So it's funny, because both language use opposite words for a flower, and I don't know where it comes from, but well, that was interesting.
That's interesting, because I'd thought as well about the flower daisy in English, and that obviously if you have that in a poem, you can have that extra layer of meaning with the eye of the day, whereas in French, if you translate that, it's Marguerite, which is more associated with a kind of female name. I think especially with proper names of things, you realise that each word has its very own kind of set of muscles and meanings that you have to tease out, and that's, that's interesting.
And you speak French, you have some French. Do you think it would have been a very different experience translating from a language that you have no knowledge of? Like, how useful was the French that you speak, and how did that help you with your translations?
I think overall, my awareness of French definitely helped with how I got an awareness of how the poem would sound, because what I did first was to read Aurelia's poems to myself aloud to get a sense of how they would come across, just to the ear, really, before any kind of meaning. Because I think with poetry, something that's more important to me than something that makes sense, it's how a poem sounds, how it conveys a certain sensibility and atmosphere. So I think if I didn't have any ability to read French aloud, then yes, I wouldn't have had that sense of the music and the rhyme and the rhythms.
I thought maybe what we could do is, Aurélia, if you read one of the poems that Tessa translated, and we'll hear it in French, and then Tessa, maybe if you could read your English version of the poem, and then afterwards I'll maybe ask you a little bit about what that process of translating was like, and any difficulties that you might have come across as you were translating. So if Aurélia, you could read your poem, which is entitled Elle.
The dialogue, so each time she speaks, she, and she talks to Ulysses. I mention it because it's not written here in this poem. Tu rêves encore. De quoi rêveras-tu là-bas sur le champ de bataille? Il y aura le jour et il y aura la nuit. Dans chacun des deux camps, les mêmes gestes, presque une routine. Bien avant l'aurore, une toilette à l'eau d'une bassine, quelques prières à des statues austères, force, courage, victoire. Là s'élève le chant du coq. Il y a la bataille, le flux et le reflux. Bien plus de cris que nécessaire, comme un jeu qui aurait trop duré. Des odeurs, cheveux qui collent sous le casque brûlant. Parfois quelque chose d'intime, l'urine contre la cuisse à l'instant de mourir. Les cigales exultent. Et puis vient le soir. On fait le compte. On avale ses dents, on lèche ses plaies. Mais tu demeures aveugle à cette pantomime, convaincu qu'il y a du courage et même un sens à tout cela.
Thank you very much. And I think now we'll hear Tessa's translational version of this part of Aurelia's poem, which, as you said, it comes from a longer poem which features Ulysses and a speaker in dialogue. So, Tessa, I will hand it over to you.
She, you continue to dream. What will you dream of out there on the battlefield? There will be day and there will be night, and on each side the same gestures, routine-like, well before dawn, a wash in a basin of water, a few prayers to crudely made statues, strength, courage, victory. The cock crows, battle begins, the ebb and flow, the shouts like a game that lasts too long, the smells, hair cloying under the burning helmets. And every so often, something more intimate, urine on a thigh at the very moment of death. At dusk, the cicadas rejoice. The final count is taken, teeth swallowed, wounds licked. But you stay blind to this pantomime, convinced in the existence of courage and even a meaning to it all.
Thank you very much. And I was just wondering, in terms of completing this translation, I know I was there while the two of you were talking through some of the things that came up, and what I found quite interesting is ways of translating things that can be slightly different from the French or that raise questions. So, for example, in Aurelia, your original, you talk about l'urine contre la cuisse à l'instant de mourir. So urine against a thigh at the moment of death. And we talked a little bit about the word contre, which I would maybe translate directly as against, urine against a thigh. And I think you translated it slightly differently, Tessa.
Yes, I said urine on a thigh. I think just for me, it felt a slightly more a quieter thing, because it was supposed to be something intimate. But again, we are yet to finalise these translations, yeah. So it could be that against may well be better.
Also, of course, that's the poetry translation, not to be literal.
Yeah.
We have some crib translation as a basis, and the crib translation would use against, because this is word by word. But all our work here is each poet who becomes a translator tries to put the other poet's poem into its own poetic language. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it makes sense what I say.
Yes, no, I think so. I mean, with that example, like saying urine against a thigh, that dramatically will change the rhythm of that line. And I think what I liked about that line is that that particular set of lines, that stanza, it starts off with battle and cries and smells and hair and the violence, and then it suddenly gets quieter. Mm. And so it was a way to finish off that with something quieter. And the word against, I think, was maybe a bit, it was louder than on. And so I just opted for on to try to recreate that quietus, that intimacy and that sense of death.
Yeah. And have either of you attempted or sort of ventured into translation before? Is this the first time that you've been actively translating either the work of another poet or your own work?
I did a translation workshop with Literature Cross Frontiers in Turkey. It was between French poets and Turkish poets. So it was absolutely the same
setup.
Yeah. And I translated a book of Hebrew poet called Amir Or into French. And I'm right now translating a Honduran poet called Rolando Catan into French.
So you've had quite a bit of experience with translation before. What about you, Tessa? Is this your first time? And sort of, because it's quite different in the way that you're working collaboratively. You're both in the same room, actively discussing the poems as they come together. Is this the first time you've done something like this?
I think that for me is the main difference, because I have, for my own pleasure, I've tried to translate various poets from various languages. But then I felt, because it was just for me, I've had the complete freedom to ignore certain lines that I might not like and completely transform the poem. So that felt more like a process of transformation and just taking the lines, playing with them. Whereas here, I've been much more aware of trying to stay much more loyal to the poet and discussing it with the poet to make sure that I'm creating something which is, yeah, in keeping what their intention was, as well as bringing my own intentions into it. So it's been, yeah, far more collaborative and,
yeah,
shared intentions and that shared sense of language and, yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, both of you, for your time, and I wish you the best of luck with your translations.
After listening to their conversation, I was especially taken with that mysterious marigold and how its feeling in French was worry, while in Occitan it became happiness. And I was reminded again of this while walking around the National History Museum in Madrid on an especially cold and rainy spring day. Entering into the aquatic area, I came across one of my favorite strange animals, the huge sunfish, which has always looked to me, even swimming in motion, like one of the rocks of Stonehenge come to life. However, when I read the plaque for this great fish, the Mola Mola, which the internet tells me is the heaviest known bony fish in the world, I found that in Spanish it is called the Pez Luna, or moonfish, calling to mind those days where one can see both the sun and the moon floating in the sky at one time. How do these animals and plants inspire such contradictory titles? And what are translators to do when the words moving from one language to another carry with them such heavy and conflicting connotations? Between the sun and the moon and worry and happiness, for now I'll try to slow down and content myself with some sound advice from the Basso essay. First of all, we must work with passion, intuition, and exuberance, and, if we are lucky, with the guidance of generous teachers. Well, that's all for our podcast this time around, but very generous thanks to Susanna V. Evans for her reporting from the field, and Roman Glazier for taking the time to tell us about his work. Until next time, for more craft and conversation, wishing you a very happy spring.
Maintenant quand je danse sous le ciel, c'est comme ça que j'ai fini. Dans cette rue qui peut parfois se montrer si belle, même si c'est bien l'enfer que j'y vis. Même si c'est bien l'enfer que j'y vis.